From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
And if the chief executive wishes to stand aside, well, not wishes to stand aside, she's been instructed to stand aside, and if she doesn't wish to do that, Mr. Speaker, she can go.
Former Australia Post CEO Christine Holgate appeared before a Senate inquiry this week to talk about the events that led to her departure from her job last year. She accused Scott Morrison, who denounced her in Parliament for giving Cartier watches as rewards to Post executives, of bullying her. She said sexism had played a role in the way she was treated, and she had particularly harsh words for Post's chair, Lucio Di Bartolomeo, for not supporting her. Her appearance led to calls for the Prime Minister to apologise to her and for the chairman to resign. Matt Canavan, a Nationals Queensland senator and former resources minister, attended the inquiry and he subsequently urged the chairman's resignation. He joins us today to talk about the Holgate affair and other issues. Matt Canavan, when the Prime Minister last October attacked Christine Holgate in Parliament, did you support his stance?
I did. I understood his stance. I can vividly recall myself doing a regular radio hookup I do with 4BC in Brisbane that afternoon, I think it was, perhaps just after the Prime Minister had spoken, and I was equally outraged. I think a lot of people were. The Labor Party, the media were a little shocked that executives in a government-owned corporation would be given bonuses or rewards of a type that was a sort of glamorous watch, a Cartier watch, and so that did cut through, as they say, there was outrage.
You don't have one?
I don't. look, I think everybody had that reaction. Now, yeah, you'll probably come to what happened after that, but the reaction of the Prime Minister was understandable, as it was for everybody, and it was a mistake. It was the wrong decision of Ms. Holgate to make, and it deserved a reprobation of some kind.
So looking back, you think she made a mistake, but would your view be as harsh now?
I think in the cold, hard light of day, there was explicable circumstances here. At the time, I knew nothing of the bank at Post deal. I mean, I think there's now this conflation that it happened during a pandemic, but I think even at the time people realised that the rewards were given pre-coronavirus. But yes, the details weren't known around why they were given. But even after all of that, I still maintain that it's not appropriate for public sector organisations to be given lavish gifts. That's not what the public expects. I have no problems with reasonable bonus arrangements for good performance. But there always has to be this understanding that as a when you're in a public sector organisation, you are dealing with other people's money. It's not the same as a listed company or a private sector business. There is a difference. And I think Ms. Holgate just made a mistake. They got that wrong, got that difference wrong. Now the media storm that erupted around it was unfair and disproportionate to the crime, but that's politics. You can't always predict what the media will latch onto, but the Cartier watches was something that people related to and was a tabloid story.
So you would like to have seen her still in her job?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a great shame that we've lost her services. I didn't know much about Ms. Holgate before all this, and I had quite a bit to do with Australia Post early on in my Senate career, but I'd gotten to a point where no news was good news because they'd had a fraught relationship with their licensed post offices, which are the small businesses that operate under an Australian Post banner, but they're effectively like franchisees. And we'd helped them, and my colleague Barry O'Sullivan and Ron Boswell, and we'd all played a role in helping them get a better deal. And Christine obviously done very good work subsequent as well, and we hadn't heard anything. And when Ms. Holgate ended up leaving, those licensed post offices in particular reached out to us again. And as I looked at it, it thought, well, this is a real shame because she has done great work. She's obviously a very well-regarded business leader. I've gotten to know Christine a little bit, and I'm very impressed with her as an individual. But it got caught up in this maelstrom, and that's been a real loss for the Australian public service and for Australians generally.
Do you give credence to her argument that there was a gender factor involved here, that she wouldn't have been treated as harshly if she was a man?
Oh, I disagree with her on that. As I said, I say this, all of what I'm saying here is someone who've got great respect and admiration for Christine and someone I've gotten to know. I think she's a very high performer, but that doesn't mean I'll always agree with somebody. I just feel that, look, if a male executive had bought Cartier watches for senior executives in a public sector organisation, that would be a story too. It would be a tabloid story. It would be controversial. And I raised this morning the case of James Shipton, which not many people know about, but very, very similar circumstances in the last 6 months where a scandal erupted over Mr. Shipton's charging of tax advice to the Australian Securities Investment Corporation, which he was the CEO of. And that has led to him leaving his job, just like Ms. Holgate, despite a finding, just like Ms. Holgate, of finding in his case that he did no wrongdoing. But again, it still didn't meet the standards of public expectations, and he's lost his job. Now, it hasn't had the same media storm, and I suppose the question is, well, is that because he's male? I'd suggest that it's probably got more to do with, in Christine's case, it dealt with something like a watch, a Cartier watch, which people can relate to, which drives newspapers, gets on the front page, runs on the news on 2GB, whereas Mr. Shipton was charging tax advice. Accountancy is not as sexy as a Cartier watch, and that's got nothing to do with males or females. It's just the way we're wired.
Do you think that the government's anger with Christine Holgate was exclusively about the watches, or did it have something to do with the still unreleased Boston Consulting Group report, which suggested a more privatised future, at least in part, for Australia Post? She resisted those recommendations.
Look, I'm really sorry. I'm just going to have to plead ignorance here. I don't know the answer to that question. I certainly had not picked up any prior to the Cartier watch situation. I had not known of any controversy in regards to a purported plan to privatise the parcel business or anything to do with the BCG report. But as I said, I there was sort of a no news is good news. There wasn't a lot of controversy about Australia Post, so it wasn't something I was heavily focused on. So I don't know. I don't know what was going on behind the scenes. I've obviously read the same report since that this was extremely controversial, both within Australia Post and possibly in its relations with governments or departments. I have spoken, though, to the minister since all this, and I pick up absolutely no appetite on behalf of the government to go down a privatisation route. Australia Post is working very well, or better, like it still has extreme challenges with the decline of the mail business, but it's much healthier than it was a few years ago. So there's just not really an appetite to upset the apple cart there. So I don't think that's something that is going to happen. If it was controversial, I don't think it is anymore. And that's not to say there aren't people in the Department of Communications that want to do this. That's pretty normal in any government for there to be different views and sometimes a competition among those views. There's a healthy tension about that that needs to be fostered in any government. It does seem that some of these disagreements have become quite unhealthy to the culture of Australia Post, and that's what I think really needs to be focused on now to fix that, because it's a very important organisation for our country.
Would the Nationals just put their foot down if there was such a plan to privatise part of Australia Post's activities?
I'm always careful. I can't speak for all my colleagues, but the short answer is yes. There would be a sufficient number of Nationals I know of personally that would be violently opposed to any plan to privatise the parcel business, because they'd be very concerned that would undermine the viability of many smaller rural post offices that have become more essential, not less, in rural communities in recent years. And we have seen banks, even some governments, particularly state government services related to agriculture, depart from many country towns. And the post offices have become one of the very few connections between some very small towns and the broader services that are offered in major cities. You're never going to get the same services in a small country town as you get in Sydney, where I am now. But the post office has become a centre point for at least some connections. And, you know, there does seem to be a viable way to keep that going under the model that Ms. Holgate in particular has developed. So let's keep that going. We'd fight very hard to maintain that.
So is this issue resonating in regional Queensland where you come from?
Look, the broader issue about postal services is a barbecue stopper in those towns. There's, as I say, no plans that I can see to change the services. So that hasn't really, I suppose, caused the barbecues to be stopped yet and discuss those things. In terms of the treatment, Ms. Holgate, look, I suppose it'll be interesting to see the feedback after the last week. I don't think there's been a great understanding of what's gone on over the last 6 months or so in Australia Post. I don't pick that up around discussions that people knew much about it. But obviously there's been a lot more coverage this week and I haven't been home since, so we'll wait and see.
And the franchisees, quite a few of them in Queensland, I think, have rallied to her support.
Oh, absolutely. And that, I think this has all the makings of becoming a very large political issue because you've got a network of very committed, understandably very committed, very passionate people who have a loyalty to Christine and are worried about their futures. So, how do you get things to become a barbecue stopper? Well, you almost always need some people to be passionate enough to talk about it at the barbecue. Most people at barbecues talk about their families, how their kids are going at school. I suppose property prices now back on the list of items, and politics comes up very rarely, but sometimes people are passionate enough to do that, and this group of people are, and so I think we've got to deal with this issue because I want to see the services continue. That's the fundamental issue. But from a political perspective, you know, we have to listen to this group because they've got a very activated network across the country and their views deserve to be heard.
Now, the new CEO is from Woolworths, a former Woolworths executive, outgoing Woolworths executive. The Nationals sometimes have problems with the big supermarkets. Do you think that he will be a good acquisition for the company?
I don't know this person. In fact, I don't know his name off the top of my head. So I'll always give someone the benefit of the doubt. But there's no doubt that he arrives with some baggage to overcome. Woolworths don't have a great reputation in regards to their treatment of smaller suppliers. They've had very adverse findings against them in the federal court in recent years with some very reprehensible conduct. Now, I believe this individual's from the logistics side of their business, so he might not have been involved in a lot of those types of negotiations. But, you know, there is that hurdle for him to overcome. In saying that, look, he has therefore, he has an opportunity to build up a relationship with a great network, a service network. I think the licensed post offices are one of Australia Post's great advantages. When you think about how they're going to position themselves against the likes of DHL and Toll, they're now competing in a very tough landscape. They don't, you know, they do have that they did have a monopoly. They're traditionally a monopoly, so they haven't had to necessarily fight for their survival, but that monopoly position in the mail business is not what it was. In fact, it's probably an encumbrance, a liability, not an asset. And so how are they going to compete on the parcel delivery side, which is very competitive? There's big international, multinational firms who are very good at this, competing with them. The one thing they've got that the Toll and DHL don't is that footprint on the ground to get goods to all Australians very quickly, no matter where they live. And I suppose, you know, this individual comes from logistics, so I'd hope to think he'd cherish that logistical advantage the Australia Post has. And if he does that and builds those relationships, well, he'll have some fans in the Nationals Party.
Just before we move off Australia Post, why do you think the chairman should resign?
I just believe he's mismanaged this process. And I suppose you haven't asked me the million-dollar question about an apology. I don't think the PM needs to apologise for his parliamentary reaction. As I say, that was understandable and everyone had a very similar reaction. But I do think we should apologise to the government for the dismount, how we've managed the situation post that initial scandal. It just hasn't been managed well. And ultimately, the person that must take the the real responsibility there is the chair of the of Australia Post. Keep in mind, the CEO of Australia Post, just like any government organisation, is not appointed by the minister or the government. The government appoints a board, and then the board, you know, under the chair's direction, hires a CEO. And so that chain of responsibility there, that's the big main job of the chair, is to find a good CEO and give them good direction. And that hasn't occurred here. I think, therefore, the buck must stop with Lucio. And I'm sure he's a very capable person. He wouldn't be in the position he's in without having lots of skills. But it's probably best for the wider organisation that the new leaf is turned over and a fresh start occurs. So I think it'd be best if he did leave.
And, of course, the dismount, as you put it, was managed much more efficiently with the Shipton case.
Seemingly. I don't know a lot of the details there, but I rest back on what I said before. No news is good news, isn't it? Where there's no smoke, there's no fire. So that hasn't attracted a lot of controversy or scrutiny.
Well, he's leaving sometime after, I think, the report and the initial controversy.
That's right. And he doesn't seem to have a grievance of any great note. As I said earlier, my understanding is no findings of wrongdoing have been concluded on him, but perceptions are important in politics. And I agree with what the Prime Minister said today, that public officials, would be they politicians, government appointees, have to be accountable. And they are accountable in a particularly robust and sometimes unfair way. But I really feel like I feel for Christine and what she's gone through, because I've been there as a minister going to estimates, facing scrutiny. It's a nerve-wracking experience, and when you slip up, you feel, 1 foot tall. But it is right and proper that ministers, that people that are spending your money, do get nervous before they go to Senate estimates. That do feel a little bit in their tummy when they walk into question time. That's a good. That should happen in our system, and it does. And it's unfortunate that sometimes a personal toll of that is very, very high. But what's the alternative? People just get a free ride and never have to face that kind of scrutiny? Well, I think that would lead to much worse outcomes.
Let's turn to the state of the Nationals. Now, even though it seems clear the election is not until next year, nevertheless, the state of the party is important, even a long way out. How do you think the party is faring as it approaches another election?
Look, I think we've got a lot of challenges for us. But with those things that we've faced for decades, there's similar issues that have beset the Nationals Party for a long time, that our traditional farming base is not what it used to be in our society, in our economy, automation. The move to the cities has undermined our traditional voting base. And so making sure that we continue to attract the votes that gives us the numbers that then have the power to do things for regional Australia is a challenge. And I think over the last decade, no one could argue that we haven't stood up, we haven't met that challenge with considerable success. We've gone through two re-election cycles without losing a seat. That's pretty much unprecedented. I struggle to find a precedent where a party of government has not lost a seat over two re-elections. So we're doing something right, but it is always a moving target, and I've expressed that I worry that we're not carving out a narrative that excites people and will continue to attract people, because the situation we've got, Michelle, is that the basis on which that success has occurred in the last in 2016 and 2019, the last two re-elections. They're not voters that are wedded to the Nationals. They're not. A lot of the voters that we've attracted to generate those results are not people that are kind of jingoistic all the way with us, whatever we do. We still have a task of constantly proving to those people that we are fighting for them, that they've made the right choice in investing their political support in us. And right now, we've got to do a better job, I think, in carving out that narrative and selling them a reason to support us again next year.
Now, you're among the group within the party that stirs the pot and puts pressure on your leader, Michael McCormack. What particularly should he be doing now to step up more decisively at the moment?
Look, I think all of this has to come down to things that we are going to do, not things that we're going to say. Obviously, there's a need to communicate in a clear and direct fashion in politics. You won't be successful otherwise. But that root cause here is that it's not words or a fascinating speech or a particularly catchy slogan or jingle that's our issue. The issue is, well, what are we going to do? What are we doing for people? My takeaway from the conversations I have with Australians around the country is there is a couple of issues out there that really dominate almost everything else but aren't the fascination of most of the media. And I think there's this massive disconnect that in Canberra, when I go to Canberra, there's a conversation about often net zero emissions, the issues, the real serious issues around sexual harassment of women, et cetera. But the kitchen table issues, when I go back to where I live, people are concerned about a couple of major things. I'm not saying they're not concerned about those things, but there's these other issues that just don't get much coverage. A big one is China. People are very, very concerned about the rise of China, the rise of their aggression, what that means. They're worried that their kids are going to have to fight another war. They seriously are worried about that. And where are we prepared for this? So they get really worried. We're not. And the other big issue, which is related, is manufacturing and the way coronavirus in particular has exposed the fragile supply chains we rely on and the fact that we don't make things as much as we used to in this country. And they're also the issues, I think, and particularly that manufacturing piece, the Nationals Party could play a really key role here.
Sounds like back to Jack McEwen days.
Absolutely. There's a lot of that. And that's different. It's obviously a different era, but there's a lot of that. I mean, from a political perspective, to sort of make it more punchy, like I think we're at our best as a party when we say or stand up for the issues that people are thinking but won't necessarily say. You know, they're a bit worried about saying they're worried about China sometimes, or at least they say it only to the people they trust. We were at our best as a party when we just sort of cut through that and say it, and we'll get ridiculed and say I get called a dinosaur all the time, but you know, the people out there that are our supporters don't care about that. They care that we're standing up for them and we're giving voice to what they care about. And so right now, the issue is, so what happens if there is another conflict in our region? We don't have enough oil. We're making these submarines that are taking decades to arrive. We're a net importer of steel, despite being the largest iron ore and coking coal exporters in the world. All of these issues we could come up with really, really serious plans to fix and solve, and I think that would rally significant support for us, because we did this with the mining sector. There was a whole bunch of people saying mining's dead, coal's dead, we've got to transition away. And at the last election in particular, we sort of said, no, we don't believe that. We believe the mining sector has growth. We back our coal industry. We want to see the Galilee Basin and Adani go ahead. And we won the high-vis vote. We won it. These are voters that traditionally voted Labor, many of them, and they rallied to us. Well, I think now there's a we can do what we did with the high-vis workers with blue-collar workers too. There's a lot of blue-collar workers in regional areas. I was just at the steelworks at Port Kembla this morning, a traditional Labor area, but a place built on the back of coal mining and steel making, which there's not a lot of people talking about that right now. So, okay, what's our plans for steel and heavy manufacturing in this country? I think there's a real space there, a need for the Nationals Party to stand up on those issues, and we'd be rewarded for it, and it would be good for the country in my view too.
But do you think that also there's an element of irresponsibility in talking up the China threat? It's a balance here, isn't it?
It is a balance, but my respectful view is, on balance, we are speaking about this too little, not too much. That it is a very, very serious issue. And if you, I mean, I hate drawing comparisons with the 1930s, although it's in vogue again. But when you think about other circumstances when a conflict has arisen, almost and certainly post the event, there's been too little preparation, not too much. There's been too little discussion about the risks, not too little. I mean, I suppose I'll take a different one because the 1930s is overused, but the lead up to the First World War, you know, that was dominated by the position that, no, we've got a Pax Britannica, there's free trade, countries can't go to war anymore because there's too much at risk for them to do so. And then what happened? We had the worst war, probably still. I mean, World War II killed more people, but World War I was just tremendously traumatic. And again, countries were completely unprepared for it. And likewise now, there's a similar sort of discussion there, that there's a reluctance to speak about it because people worry, understandably worried about the consequences. But I think we're better to, the sooner we tackle that, the better prepared we'll be and the better for everyone.
Well, in this context, and as you're from Northern Australia generally, do you think that we should be taking some action on the lease of the Port of Darwin to get it back?
Look, I generally have not thought this is the most important issue. I mean, just if we just deal with it on its own and its own terms, if you want to know what's going on at the Darwin Port, just hire an office in the Paspali building there and you'll see everything that's going on. It's not particularly a private space and it's not a particularly busy port either. So I don't know if, you know, having a Chinese company own the port has fundamentally reduced our security at this point. What I do think we do need to do, though, is we do need to take action when China does things that are illegal. So if there is the view or belief that that China won't invade Taiwan, and this is the big issue, right? China won't invade Taiwan because America will defend it. I'm very concerned that that deterrence is becoming weaker and weaker every day we let China do illegal things, but there's no consequences for them. I'm not saying that the actions China have taken right now deserve a ramping up to conflict, but I think they would deserve a stronger response than we've seen. They are encroaching on Taiwan's airspace. China is flaunting international rules in the South China Sea. They're taking clearly illegal trade action against us. Yet there's almost zero consequence for China for these actions. And that approach is only going to encourage more poor behaviour. So whether it's taking back the Darwin port, or I suggested, well, if the trade sanctions continue, why don't we levy our iron ore exports to help subsidise the wine producers who have been subjected to illegal trade sanctions from China? Let's do something. Let's do something. Because if we are serious about defending peace and prosperity in our region, we should be willing to pay some price now to defend that. If we're not willing to pay a price now, we're kidding ourselves that we're going to pay an even larger price when the stakes become higher.
Just going back to the Nationals leader, is Michael McCormack safe until the election?
Look, I always think this is, you've got to perform. I suppose going back to where we started, it is a tough environment. And if Michael performs and we're in a good position, he'll be right. He'll be absolutely right. But I don't believe in giving, no one in public life like Ms. Holgate, we should apply the same standards to ourselves as been applied to her, that you've got to perform. And that creates a very robust and difficult environment. But when you think about, like, there's been a lot of talk about the stress and pressures involved in politics this week. When you think about the stress and pressures, say, of our sporting people, and I know it's a bit trite, but they face incredible stress. They're evaluated in public every week, every drop ball, every mistake is highlighted and talked about a lot more than our mistakes. they get a lot more criticism than we do, at the barbecues especially. Yet, they can be dropped any week. And that's the environment they're in. And likewise, we're a performance-based environment. And if we are not in a position to win, well, obviously we have to have a look at those things. There should never be a blank check.
Even before the election?
Yeah, I think the last 10 years has demonstrated that despite how volatile it's been, leadership changes have often been to the benefit of parties. And if the Liberals had not changed leader before the last election, I struggle to see that we would have won. So obviously it was important for the Liberal Party to constantly evaluate whether the leader was doing the right thing, doing the right job. And likewise, it's got to be the same in our own, but should be the same approach in our own party.
Former Senator Fiona Nash has just withdrawn from this pre-selection race for the New South Wales Senate spot. Does this now lead the way open for John Anderson to have a pretty clear run, do you think?
I wouldn't say clear. There's no doubt John has an easier run. Fiona was a very formidable candidate with a lot of support in the New South Wales Nationals. And I respect her decision, but it was, I think, heartening to see both Fiona and John wanting to be part of our team. They're both very talented people. But look, every pre-selection is really, really tough, and particularly Senate ones. They're no easy ride. And look, I'm not trying to make two partisan a point, but in our parties, especially in the Nationals Party, it's a very open race. There is no central direction. In fact, at least in terms of the LNP, which I think has a similar culture, if you get the executive to back you, it's almost certainly an encumbrance, not a benefit. Look what's happened in the Andrew Lambing situation. The reports are suggesting that, you know, the Prime Minister wanted a free ride for one candidate. Well, what did the locals do? Said, no, we're not doing that. We're going to have an open pre-selection. And that's just the culture of our party, that almost certainly whatever the bosses want, our loyal, dedicated foot soldiers decide, no, this is our party, we run it, and we'll make our own decisions. So the worst thing that could have happened for John and his candidacy is to be somehow anointed as like the person, because a lot of people then actually would be encouraged to vote for someone else just to show everyone who's boss.
There's the broader question too, isn't there? Is bringing back a party elder a way to put more power into the engine, or is it just blocking the path of a younger person, a newcomer, who will be important in the party's future?
Well, look, I think that just depends on the particular makeup and circumstances of a group of people at any one time, a party room in our case. We've got a very young Nationals party room. In the case of the Senate, which John's seeking to join, Bridget and I are the most longer-serving National senators. I think Bridget came in around 2012 or so, or maybe 2010, 2020 election, I think, so sometime after that. And I was elected in 2013, came in in 2014, so not that long. And in the House, I think Barnaby's our longest-serving MP, and after that perhaps Darren Chester in 2008. So it's a pretty young team, and I actually think it would be great to have someone of John's experience to help and mentor people in our party room. We probably lack someone who plays that role right now, so that would be...
Would he fit into that rather bolshy Senate sub-party?
I wouldn't assume anything with John. I don't think that would be fair to characterise him like that. He's very much his own man. And I very much think, and I'm not trying to speak for John, but I think he, you know, his days of wanting to do roundtables with stakeholders are, you know, that he doesn't want to return to the ministry and do that sort of humdrum jobs. He's making a major contribution to the intellectual richness of our country. He's doing podcasts like we're doing now. I listen to them quite a lot. He's a real thought leader. I think having the platform of the Senate, you know, would just give him a bit, just amplify that voice a bit. As I say, I think he'd also play a very stabilising and educating sort of role in our party room. But look, as I say, coming back, there's going to be, and I know there are very good other candidates in the New South Wales Nationals Party that are keen on the Senate, and this is not going to be a lay down mezzanine for John Anderson. It'll be a tough race.
Now, just finally, it's been already a somewhat tough year, to put it mildly, for Scott Morrison. Do you think he's lost significant support in your home state of Queensland since the last election? And can he win that support back? And how should he do that? How would he do that?
Yeah, look, I don't think he's lost support per se. I do think people are a little... perplexed, confused about what's happened in the last few months, whether it, you know, all of the scandals involving Miss Higgins and then subsequently others, it's taken the focus for us off what they perceive we should be doing, which is obviously developing our country, protecting their job, protecting our nation, all those things. So they see us as a little distracted at the moment, perhaps, and that obviously potentially comes up in polls and things like that. But I don't think there's a great, you know, shifting permanently away. It's just, a little bit of a look away, and they'll come back and look at us again, but we've got to prove ourselves. I mean, putting aside the stuff that's come out around a collection of related misbehaviour in reference to women, big serious issue, I'm concerned that we sort of got ourselves off the wrong foot. I mean, at the start of this year, we changed the national anthem. We came out and supported net zero emissions. I just don't think that's what our people want to hear.
What about the rollout, the vaccine rollout, and the problems around that?
Oh, I don't. That's interesting. I don't think people are penalising us for that too much just yet. I think that's fair. I think what surprised me the most about the coronavirus, Michelle, is how fair people have been in their judgments of governments. You know, the last 10 years has been, you know, there's pretty brutal reactions usually to any government incompetence. There's been a low tolerance for any mistakes in the past decade with regard to politicians or governments. But when coronavirus hit, I was astounded at the goodwill of Australian people who were suffering very, very traumatic experiences. You know, businesses didn't know whether they'd be able to open their doors next week, people who didn't know if they'd have a job. Yet there was just, you know, a real understanding. I think that was because this was a real issue. This was a real existential is too strong a word, but a very traumatic event, the likes of which we hadn't faced as a nation probably since the early 1990s recession. And so suddenly when things got real, people really responded, and that gives me great faith in the common sense of the Australian public. So likewise here, people understand this is a really, really tough task, rolling out a vaccine in, well, we wanted to do it under 12 months to everybody in the country. We've never tried this. When you look around the world, almost every country is struggling to roll out the vaccine. Now, we are in a very, very lucky circumstance that we're not also tackling the major outbreak of a pandemic while trying to roll out the vaccine. So I think it's been absolutely the right move to take time, to be cautious. We've seen risks, well, yes, albeit rare ones, but risks associated with some vaccines, and absolutely proven the wisdom of just taking our time here, not panicking. So I actually think, despite the media, the media's got to sell papers, so beat things up, the average Australian person is sort of sitting back quite calm, thinking, okay, we're very lucky in this country. Let's just take it step by step. We're very lucky that as a world that we've had these other vaccines developed and we've got a choice. So a bit of a problem with AstraZeneca. Well, we got Pfizer. We'll be right. We'll get through it.
Matt Canavan, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with you again soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.